Honey, great news. I got the tickets.
Tickets to what?
The MLU championship game. We talked about this.
Wait, you paid money to watch that stupid frisbee thing you do?
It's not a stupid thing. It's a sport.
It's not a sport? How can it be a sport if it's something that dogs are good at?
It's totally a sport. This is the elite version of Ultimate. We're talking Philadelphia Spinners versus the Boston Whitecap, the same matchup where last year Billy Sickles threw a greatest chicken wing and Himalaya Maeda laid out for the sickest catch ever.
I'm going to have Lieutenant Uhuru run that through the translator so I can hear it in Earth speech.
It hurts so much when you laugh at something that's really important to me.
Jonathan, let me be serious for like a second. You're in a cult. You've gone four nights a week. You're covered with scabs. You've lost all interest in sex, and you're eating garbage out of dumpsters.
That was just that one time after the match against Ring of Fire. I was exhausted and starving, and Chili's was closed.
I can't take any more of this.
Just go to the one game. I think you'll understand.
I'd love to, but I have tickets to the National Squirt Gun Championships the same day.
I hate you.
And now, he would have been the greatest Ultimate player ever if Tonya Harding hadn't broken his fingers. Colin McEnroe.
Yeah. I'm not even sure why she broke my fingers. I don't know that it was necessarily to ruin my chances at Ultimate Frisbee, or as it is called these days, Ultimate. So we are going to talk about the Frisbee. We're going to talk about it as a thing. We're going to talk about its history. That's going to come a little bit later. We are going to talk, not in the kind of attitude of that woman you just heard in the intro, not at all, about Ultimate Frisbee, a game that, in fact, is incredibly physically, aerobically demanding, and which aspires to the status of sport. It may have reached the status of sport. That's something that is to be debated and might even be debated here. I think it's fair to say that it is somewhat maligned by some people anyway. Like people like that woman in that intro. So let me tell you who's here. Joining us in the studio, I wouldn't have dreamed of doing this show without my friend Dan Haar, columnist for the Hartford Courant and a legend in the world of Connecticut Ultimate. Joining us also in studio is Dan O'Connor, president and CEO of the Frisbee Pie Company. Whence cometh the name of the thing that you play Ultimate Frisbee with, except you don't, as it turns out, play Ultimate Frisbee or Ultimate with something that's actually called a Frisbee. See, it's going to get really complicated. It's already gotten really complicated. Also joining us from studios in, I think, I'm not sure where, from studios in a place to be disclosed later will be David Gessner, the author of Ultimate Glory, Frisbee, Obsession, and My Wild Youth. And later on in the show, because we are not exclusively devoted to Frisbees, although we are slavishly devoted to them. We have lots of Frisbees in the studio right now. We're going to also talk about the fact that the pickleball championships are coming.
Upstart sport.
It's an upstart sport, yeah. But see, people said that about you, you know, at one time. People said that about you. You should have some kind of ecumenical attitude about this because, you know, I mean, you've been there, right?
We had a broader purpose in life. We were countercultural.
You really are looking down your nose at the pickleball people. That's wrong.
I don't know how
already
aerobic yet. You know, I just don't know enough about it.
All right. So that's the voice that you hear is the voice of Dan Haar, a longtime Ultimate Frisbee. What are we going to say? Are we going to say Ultimate Frisbee or are we going to say Ultimate?
Let us start, in my opinion, by saying that the word Frisbee has been the trademark has been abrogated by WAMO, in my opinion. I have never, in 30 years of doing this, of calling it by its generic name, been notified by the company that you have done something wrong. As a journalist, I typically am. If I say Xerox when I mean copier, I actually get a letter from Xerox.
Right.
Not the case with Frisbee. We play, in my opinion, the generic game of Ultimate Frisbee with a disc that is made by Discraft, right, not WAMO.
Yeah, maybe Dan O'Connor can shed a little light on that. You actually are an expert on the physical thing that is sometimes called a Frisbee, but I feel like this is the Knights Who Say Knee or something. This is something that is often called a Frisbee, but is not necessarily by name a Frisbee. So the thing that's played in regulation, competition, Ultimate Frisbee is not brand-wise a Frisbee, correct?
Well, to Dan's point, it is called a flying disc.
A flying disc.
But as you think about it,
yeah,
the name, as it's derived, is actually from, it's got historical roots from the Frisbee Pie Company, which was from and is in Bridgeport, Connecticut to this day. So the name, as you think about it, that being Frisbee, and a tossing of a frisbee, this case a frisbee pie tin,
yeah,
predated what we know today, or what became known as the toy, the frisbee.
Right. So we're going to deal a little bit with that in the second section of the show. But I mean, the important thing to know is that if you are witnessing a game of ultimate that is like at some kind of league level, it's actually the thing that they're throwing, the flying disc that they're throwing, is not necessarily made by Wham-O. It's not necessarily by brand a frisbee. Now we now have to explain. So often, Dan, when I'm Dan Har, I'm when I'm. Maybe I'll just go back to calling you Danny like I used to.
You're going to have to today, yeah. And I'm going to give you a special dispensation.
All right. So, Danny, often I'm walking around Elizabeth Park, and there are these people doing this, and it really does look like a lot of fun. And it sort of looks kind of like touch football, but people are running more constantly. That's about as much of a grasp of as I had of it until I read David Gessner's book. But explain what Ultimate Frisbee actually is.
Ultimate Frisbee is a sport of running and scoring that combines the offensive patterns of soccer. The scoring is football. You essentially throw a touchdown pass. The defense most represents basketball, and the running style is hockey, short sprints, followed by some resting, followed by some more sprints. The higher the level you go, the more sprinting, as in hockey. If you watch the NHL, they're always sprinting, and if you watch the AUDL, they're always sprinting. And so that's really what it is. It's a running sport, and it's organized at its beginning without coaches and sort of a superstructure, and that's a great deal of the debate today about what direction the sport should go.
You just said, if I watch the AUDL?
American Ultimate Disc League, yes. Well, that was the Spinners versus Boston that we were—
Oh, that's what that is.
That is the professional league of which Connecticut had a team for, I think, 1 year, the Connecticut Constitution, before there was a territorial dispute involving teams in Boston and New York. Unfortunately, Connecticut lost that team, but it was a great team and was the site of the greatest catch ever by Anderson. Brian Anderson?
I think you're correct on that, Dan. Yeah, that made a top 10.
Top 10 ESPN plays of the month.
He's no Himalaya Mehta, who is an actuary, by the way. All right, so before I get any deeper into this, I should mention that we are doing this show today, as we do about twice a month, on two Thursdays of a month. We do something that we call Radio for the Deaf. It is, in fact, radio that is designed to be enjoyed and appreciated. Well, I mean, it's designed to be utilized anyway. I can't guarantee anyone's going to enjoy or appreciate it by members of the deaf community. The way we do it is we have two fabulous ASL interpreters who are here in studio with us. One of them is interpreting into ASL everything that I say. Another is interpreting everything that Danny and Dan and David and other guests will say. They are, respectively, Mary Sue Owens, my regular interpreter, and Sarah D'Agostino, who handles the guests. And all of this can be seen on the Facebook page of the Colin McEnroe Show. So if you go to Colin McEnroe Show on Facebook, you'll see a video feed that shows this ASL interpretation. And we really want to do this and ultimately get other radio stations across the country to do this so that what we think of, what we take for granted as radio, can be enjoyed by an audience that ordinarily can't access it. Okay, so back to this conversation. So reading David Gessner's book, Danny Har, I feel like I'm also reading a little bit of your story, right? This is a game. It may aspire ultimately to be a sport. I guess maybe it is a sport already. It might even eventually be an Olympic sport. But it's a game people seem to have picked up a lot in college, right?
Well, we had a sort of a great awakening of the sport in the era that was when Dave and I, and I think Dan too, were in college. Dan was a tiny bit younger, where all of a sudden it ballooned from something like 10 teams in 1974. Dave has the numbers, to about 60 2 years later, and then it really mushroomed after that in the early 80s, such that many, many, many colleges had teams. And that led to the club culture that still dominates today. It's not the pro game that dominates ultimate. It's the club game that dominates. And I would make one correction. I did live the life, except that the secret to my longevity in the sport and the reason that I'm still playing competitively today is that I was never all that good. At least I was never an elite player, which I think Dave was, so there's the difference.
Right. Well, I think we have David Gessner on the line from the studio right now. I was going to make that same point, that David Gessner is an elite player, but maybe was an elite player. He's in senior status, but even so had other people that he looked up to, sometimes actually even physically had to look up to because they were so tall. This is, I mean, David Gessner, one thing that you do right away in this book is convince somebody like me that this is an incredibly demanding sport. Played at a fully competitive level, this is aerobically up there with just about anything. I don't know if you want to elaborate on that.
Well, first I want to emphatically say that was an elite player is the correct sentence. I just played in great Grand Masters for 50 and over, and I was even slower than I was at my slowest a decade ago. So but you know, when I did play, it was insane what we would do on a weekend. We'd get in there on a Saturday morning and we'd play four or five games. Then if we made it to the quarters, we'd play on Sunday, play the semis, and if we were lucky, get to the finals. So it was like 2 days of just running the whole time. And you're running in, you know, it's kind of a soccer style running, but it's also sprinting and bursting. And so we would laugh at like the pros who would say, oh, I'm tired because I had a game yesterday, you know, because we were just piling the games on. And I just went to see the pros play in Montreal last weekend. And boy, if you don't think it's athletic, just go out and watch those guys for half an hour. It's crazy.
So, David, I sense a tension here. And let me explain it as best I can, and then maybe you can speak to it. And the tension that I sense, and it's in your book and it's in the conversation that we're having right now, is that on the one hand, there are an awful lot of people who play this game who realize that it's demanding, it's challenging, it's aerobically exhausting even compared to something like soccer, and that it certainly deserves the status of a sport, and a sport that would be taken seriously and maybe even covered on the sports pages of newspapers, right, and carried on television. On the other hand, its wellsprings are a little bit in this kind of utopian world that in many respects was an implicit rejection of everything about other kinds of organized exalted sports, right? That there were
right.
Anyway, why don't you take, you're better at explaining this than I am.
I'm going to try to parse this out in two different ways.
Okay.
One is that utopian's a little wrong for me. It's like anarchy more than utopia because, you know, I say in the book, isn't it really a hippie sport the way they're saying it? When Joel Silver, and I don't know if you guys have covered this already.
We haven't got to Joel Silver yet, no.
Well, the movie producer who later would give us, you know, Lethal Weapon and Xanadu and The Matrix, when he took the game from Northfield Mount Hermon Prep School and this rudimentary version of the game and brought it back to Columbia, he was already doing it as kind of a lark when he made it a varsity sport at Columbia. He was calling the pull, the kickoff. He had just seen Thunderball with James Bond, the James Bond movie, where there was a skeet shooting scene. So it would be, and that would be, you know, pull. So that's where pull comes from. And there were jokes in the rules about, you know, we will play until one player dies. So it was from the beginning, it was more like Mad Magazine than it was hippy dippy. So that beginning made fun of authority. So even as recently as 3 years ago, when ESPN was filming the national finals, the crowd chanted, "Not a real sport." So there's this kind of like,
but they chanted that lovingly, right?
Lovingly, they were frisbee players who were chanting that. So there's this self-mockery, and as I say, there's a Rodney Dangerfield element to the sport because you're always explaining, you're always saying, "Oh, you know." People are always saying to you, is that the thing you do with dogs?
Right.
And I was away from the game for 20 years and came back, and I was just doing a reading in Portland, Oregon, and I had five or six Uber drivers, and of those, only one knew what ultimate was. Mm-hmm. So there's always a defensiveness about the sport. There's always like, I'm explaining it, or, you know, I once broke my wrist and told the doctor how I did it, and he laughed out loud at me. So you're coming at it from this place. No, it's not tiddlywinks. No, it's not hula hoops from the beginning. And I noticed, having been away for two decades, that that's still there.
So, David,
as real as the athletes are, as pro as they are, as strong as they are, there's still that aspect of like having to explain what you're doing.
So, David, Danny Haar, Connecticut ultimate legend, is also here with us today.
Hey, Danny.
And I can tell you want to talk about this. I don't know. You've got something you want to say. Well, go ahead and say it. And
well,
then I'll
first of all,
over.
We're all legends in our own mind in this sport. And the older we are, the better we were. So
The drunker we are, the better we were.
Exactly. The divide that I see is not so much between the style of sport that it is, but it's definitely a sport. It's a rigorous, highly articulated sport. The question I see is, where is the sport going? And right. Should it become more codified and directed, like, say, lacrosse and rugby? Those are the sports that the organizers in Ultimate look at and say, we want to be like lacrosse and rugby in terms of their superstructure.
Right. And let me just press on that a little bit, Danny, so the people are clear about what you're talking about. My sense is, Danny, that from the point of view of the Ultimate purists, maybe the people who were around at or near the beginning, there's this sense that every time you add anything that resembles structure, whether it's a ref, you know, or, I don't know, jerseys with numbers or, you know, anything, right. anything like that, you are diluting and maybe despoiling a little bit of that pure moment of paradise when this game was played a certain way.
Some of the old-timers want to see that progression and some don't. I would say overall there probably is a greater correlation to the older players who don't want to see that progression. And I'm in the camp that doesn't want anything to do with the Olympics or the Olympic movement and the entire corruption of international sport. Why does Ultimate need that? It doesn't. And other people probably... both Dan and Dave will say, no, that's going to be great for the sport.
Well, I want to ask Dan O'Connor about this. So once again, president and CEO of the Frisbee Pie Company in Bridgeport, so the only actual businessman among us.
That's right.
So, well, from a business perspective, can this thing be something other than what it is now?
I believe, and to David's points and also Danny's, the growth of the sport, I think, reflects the popularity. And again, whether it's grassroots, hey, we all aspire to the NFL, but with very, you know, the viewership of what drives that, in reality, participation and other things are declining. Think about concussions. Think about other things that are going on in sports overall. So I don't see it necessarily aspirationally, the Olympics and being there is a huge opportunity. But the real spirit of the game and what I do every day and pretty much every day of my life, which I'm so fortunate, I'm playing Ultimate Frisbee. I've been playing for over 30 years, over 40, let's call it what it is. So I'm in Danny and David's age bracket and still competing. So I love it, but I'm also competing now, and I say compete because we're out there having fun in the competition around it with my friends and their siblings, or their children, I should say. So we're out there running around. So it's generational. It's exciting. There's so much activity going on. So I think you can achieve both is my take on it.
So David Gessen, first of all, explain, what is the status of Ultimate or Ultimate Frisbee vis-a-vis the Olympics? I think in your book you say it's at a contender. I don't even know the rankings, the steps that you have to go up to before you get to be a medal sport in the Olympics. But it's somewhere in that continuum, right?
Is it okay if I answer this like a politician and wend my way back to the final answer? Because I want to respond to Danny's comment first.
It's called a pivot.
I'm going to pivot. And say that the historically, you know, you had in the early 70s, you had Rutgers in their team bus and with their scoreboard going to play Tufts, and they had numbers on their shirt. So Tufts decided to all wear number threes as their response, like their screw you kind of response to the official way of Rutgers. Then you have Jose Cuervo coming in and having had success with beach volleyball, and they wanted people to wear numbers and not smoke joints on the sideline. And then they foolishly, at the end of the tournament, the first one they ran, opened the bar for an hour for free tequila. And Frisbee players were crawling over to get the tequila, and they rolled their eyes and said, these guys aren't ready for prime time. And my friend D. Rambeau, who ran the tournament, said, if we can't sell this to a tequila company, who can we sell it to? So that's the history. There's always been push forward, pull back. I guess what I don't see is why you can't have 99% of Ultimate be old, wild, you know, fun, and have 1% be like the pro game I watched this weekend, where they had refs and no arguments, I don't know that we have to. Having said that, I think what's going on with the Olympics right now, to pivot back, is we are contorting the game a little. I hear that it's going to be maybe beach ultimate, which is five players, not seven, co-ed ultimate, trying to do anything we can, kind of desperately, to get into the Olympics. And that does not seem like my idea of spirit of the game, which is we're going to do whatever the hell we want.
All right. And what about countries that don't have nerds? No, I'm just kidding. That slipped
out. No, there's actually a surprising amount of nerd countries out there. Japan's very good. Costa Rica has a team now. There's Sweden. You know, Sweden's good. You know, there's a lot of nerd countries.
So, Danny Harris, you're worried that like if it became an Olympic sport, then Russia would start like worrying about oxygen uptake and putting turtle glands inside nerds.
We're already doing that.
Yeah, but not at the ultimate, right?
First of all, to pivot on the pivot, I want to give a left brain.
Let's
answer.
Just keep pivoting just and pivot. Call
well,
traveling
we do a lot
on
of
each
pivoting.
Other.
You have to. By
I
the way,
knew this was going to happen.
In ultimate,
I guess I asked for it.
In ultimate, the player who's holding the disc has to, in fact, pivot and can't run with the disc. Exactly. But in answer to your original question, the International Olympic Committee has recognized ultimate as a sport, and it has yet to be scheduled as a sport in competition. The hope is 24 in, I believe.
Well, actually, I believe, and this is my take on it, I've heard the short list for 24
right.
is a possibility, but I'm excited. And the reason why I say it, 2028, Los Angeles.
Los Angeles, right. Yeah.
So
right.
I'm personally, 11 years out, we'll be at that age bracket where we can really enjoy ourselves.
Some of us will still be alive.
That's my plan, exactly. So the heroes that we were are, you know, those right. that are but in the sport are still going to be, and I believe that could be a great opportunity.
But Danny, you really don't like this idea.
No, I don't. I still think that ultimate had its apogee in the fields by the Charles River and under the 59th Street, now Ed Koch Bridge, where the great teams came of age in the 80s. And what
Giants
I'm saying
roamed
about
the earth.
What I'm saying, what's that?
Giants roamed the earth.
Exactly. And what I'm saying about the Olympics is I don't think that the sport should be any less of an athletic hardcore pursuit. And I do think we are attracting now great, great athletes who would have pushed us out, at least speaking for myself, in the 80s from what was then the highest level of the sport. We're getting these great, great players like NBA style, you know, bodies that are playing, starting right now. And so I'm not against the athleticization of the sport further. I'm against the corruption of international sports culture that says we'll pay you X if you do Y under the table, and there's no way to stop that. I don't care how many indictments they get in the IOC.
Money changes everything. Hey, as long as you're mentioning NBA bodies, let me bring up another tripwire or third rail. Or me. This is probably my own blind prejudice about ultimate, of which I confess to having lots. But I was think of it as like the whitest thing ever.
I think it's actually listed in that book, like things white people do. Yeah. It's getting less so. And if you want to watch SportsCenter and see Jakeem, the guy he played for Atlanta last year. I mean, it's pretty exciting. And you can imagine if it wasn't the whitest sport ever, if you had an NBA infusion, you know, it's to me the thing that would keep the game wild. Is the physics of the disc, the hovering. That's what leads to the diving. That's what leads to like SportsCenter style plays, the way it waits for you and the way it sits up there at like 10 feet in the air. And so if it really was lucrative, you'd have the best jumpers, the best athletes going up and snacking that thing from. And it's a thrilling moment.
I've got the clip.
Right
of
now,
the...
it's a pretty white moment, but it could
actually,
expand.
No, actually, in 1983, I was on the Hartford club team called the Tourists, and we joined forces with an all black team from Waterbury called the Mob.
The Mob.
Yep. And we played tournaments, and actually, we played in the Ultimate Affair. I think we might have beaten you guys, the Hostages. I'm not sure. I think we beat you guys. But it was
I'm sure you tell stories about it to this day.
We think we beat you, yes. But all kidding aside, that had been an all black team, and we formed a team called the Naz that was fully integrated.
All right. For those of you still listening, we're going to take a little break here. We're going to come back. We've got to get Dan O'Connor to talk a little bit more about the history, the complicated and very Connecticut-centric history of the Frisbee itself.
On top of a Frisbee as big as a plane. Now I got the ultimate Frisbee. It does phenomenal things. It can fly anywhere when it glides through the air. It doesn't even need wings.
We are back. It's very hard to control Ultimate Frisbee people. They do whatever they want to do. We're talking about the world of the Frisbee, the dark secret world of the Frisbee, with David Gessner, whose book, Boy, a Frisbee Needs Certain Things, It probably needs a book like this one. It really is, all kidding aside, a terrifically written book, Ultimate Frisbee. The book is called Ultimate Glory, Frisbee Obsession and My Wild Youth. It's a lot of fun to read, even for somebody like me who mainly makes fun of people like Danny Hart. It's a great sports book. So he's on with us, Danny Haar, columnist for the Hartford Current and Connecticut Frisbee legend, is here with us. And also in studio with us is Dan O'Connor, who's president and CEO of the Frisbee Pie Company in Bridgeport. So now we have to go back even further in time than Joel Silver, further in time to the very origins of the Frisbee. So I'm holding in my hand one of Dan Haar's 8,000 plastic flying discs that, you know, if you wrap them together, they sound like this. But I'm also holding here a couple of the things that's preceded those things, and they sound like this. So, Dan O'Connor, I'm going to let you take over the story. I've heard all kinds of legends, and I think there's some disagreement about exactly what happened. But as far as you know, how did this whole thing get going?
Well, Colin, thank you again for the intro. I really, if you think about rolling back the time frame, you're thinking 1871. So U.S. 1871, post-Civil War, a lot of things going on. We've got a lot of activity. A young man named William Russell Frisbee, his son was Joseph. But William Russell Frisbee left along the shoreline, Brantford, Connecticut, and moved from what was Old's Bakery to Bridgeport, Connecticut. So this is 1871, August, and he moved into a small fat bakery, and it was called the Frisbee Pie Bakery in 1871. The name, the company, grew as pies and local bakeries grew throughout the area through the early 1900s. Upon his passing in about 1902, 1903, his son Joseph took over. Joseph ran the company throughout primarily the Northeast, and I speak Connecticut into Rhode Island, and that includes Hartford and Bridgeport specifically in those areas and up to Poughkeepsie, New York. So a lot of coverage within the New England region, and sales were very strong. They continued to be very strong. And to your point, what was going on at the same time with tossing of tins. So the actual tins were being tossed, cookie tins, pie tins as we see in front and what you're sharing with the audience today. Those were used. But what rose to the top was Frisbee, the name Frisbee and the Frisbee pie tins. The reason being is, as we experimented a little earlier, they flew quite well. But also the name resonated. So on the college campuses, they would throw it. And I assimilate it to in the vernacular today of yelling four when a golf ball is coming your way. At the time, those that were throwing and it was heading in someone's direction, they would yell Frisbee. So the name stuck. And it stuck about the participation in the throwing of the tins, which was becoming very popular. And when you look historically, there were games that were created using pie tins and other flying tins, cookie lids, and so forth. But that aside, the name stuck.
Well, Dan, you say universities.
Yes.
I hold no brief for this, but I did attend what my friend Alex Beam calls America's second greatest university. And there is this idea that Yale in particular has some claim on this whole idea of throwing these tins around. How does that sit with you?
Well, I would say it's open for conversation. I don't think there's any geographical or specific location, but I would almost tip my hat to Yale.
Yeah,
I think
no
that,
doubt.
Yeah.
Which is why Colin has, if he had come just a few years later at Yale, there's almost no doubt that he would have been an ultimate player given the cultural touchstones.
Right,
almost
there.
No
I
doubt.
Was there in 1869, yeah. Before this whole thing really started took off.
So to that said, I think Yale giving credit, but I also give credit to some of the workers at the plant who initially were throwing them around, and it started from that location and built out.
That's typically the way Yale does everything. Ordinary working people get this thing started, and then somebody at Yale grabs it and licenses it, and that's the end of it. So just very quickly here, because I don't want to lose track of this.
Sure.
You sort of reactivated the pie company. Explain what you did with the pie company.
Yes. So long story short, with my passion for ultimate Frisbee and all Frisbee things, I had the opportunity not only from my experience, my professional experience of 30 years in sales and marketing, but also early on finding out and hearing the history and saying, hey, wouldn't this be a great opportunity to revisit and find out about the company, explore, make some contacts, and work from that point where I was able to actually work directly with the owner of the name and acquire the licensing and distribution rights. So it's a wonderful situation, a wonderful partnership that's really grown not only today, about 8-9 months into it, selling pies, but also sharing the story and the history with those that are have an ear and want to hear about the great history of not only this great pie company, but also the sports that come with it.
So, David Gessner, to whatever degree Ultimate Frisbee as a sport wants to come out from under the whatever kind of shadow it's been under for all of its existence, how much of that has to do with the story? I mean, do you think how much of it has to do with the story that Dan O'Connor just told? In other words, a baseball or a basketball or a football didn't used to be something else. It's not a repurposed thing. It was invented to play the sport. In a baseball and a basketball and a football, they claim anyway not to be sort of child's toys. There's a way in which the Frisbee, because of the name, I don't know. Yeah, you take it from there.
Well, first of all, the word Frisbee, as I say in the book, it's like boing. It's just a word that's hard to take seriously, the way it sounds, even if you didn't know what it meant, even if you didn't associate it with the closet in Summers and throwing the little plastic thing. And then Joel Silver, out of kind of a joke impulse, putting the word ultimate in front of it. So you have the pretentious adjective followed by boing kind of word. And that really, I feel like we'd be in a little different place if it had been called field disc, you know, or something.
Right.
You know, it's a disc, you know, like a ball. Now, I'm fine with where we are because it's funnier and weirder and it was much better to write about it the way it came out. But I do feel like we weren't just apologizing for the thing itself, but the name and the association with tiddlywinks and hula hoops and the toy aspect. Now, as I said before, the way it physically flew. And, you know, I always take the opportunity to knock Yale down a notch or two. So Kenyon College had the oven mix cake tin in the 40s and played a game called Ace Ball. So it was, you know, it was happening at a lot of different places, though Yale's the most famous place where we knew it started. But, you know, so that aspect of it, the toy aspect, you're throwing a plate around, they all kind of combine for that inferiority complex, which I shouldn't say it like, I think it's a horrible thing. I think it's part of the joy of the game is that you're playing something and throwing your life into something that others consider ridiculous. I write in the book about building muscles of nonconformity because you'd win a national championship and people would go, huh? So there was something about, you know, kind of the epigraph for the book is Emerson's, whoso should be a man must be a nonconformist. So I like the weirdness of it, but it's certainly makes it harder to sell to a normal person.
Right. By the way, I should just say, just in terms of heroism, I do have on my Facebook page, as Danny will tell you, a clip of the great Himalaya Mitta catch last year in that game. So I can appreciate what these people do. But so Danny Haar, let me have you put on one of your many other hats. You know, one thing that happens with sports is they get covered in newspapers. To the extent that newspapers will still exist, you know, they may not make it to 2028 in the LA Olympics. But you know, there's a sports section in which I doubt any Ultimate Frisbee has ever appeared.
We're almost always in metro sections of newspapers when we're in there. Almost.
Because one of you got shot in a park or something? Or?
There are people in this world who accept Ultimate as a full-fledged sport. Sports editors at newspapers in America are not among those people.
But is that because they have a vested interest in thinking what a sport is? They have, in other words, a canon. They have a canonical understanding of what sports are. They're probably not. They're especially not. I could probably go out in the newsroom and convince somebody that this is a sport easily.
Some of them are just starting to accept tennis, which Dave and I grew up playing competitively. I think we have that in common. So no, that's not. But the other problem with the sport is that in order, as is evidenced in this our show here today, anytime you talk about Ultimate, first of all, we're the only sport ever that is not allowed to use its name. It's right. Ultimate Frisbee, for crying out loud. That's stupid. Yeah. And second of all, every time you do an article in a newspaper, you have to sort of re-explain the sport. And so there are really only three or four types of ultimate stories out there. One is, hey, this is fast-growing. Another is, hey, I bet you didn't know how hard this is aerobically. Another is, hey, these are really like hippie roots. And another is, they argue a lot with each other. That was in the New York era with a fellow named
Kenny
Don't
forget Spirit of the Game.
Spirit of the Game. Yes, Spirit of the Game.
Yeah. And Spirit of the Game, once again, just so we understand what we're talking about. David, that's what we were talking about before, this notion that it is somewhat anarchical, that it enjoys its anarchical qualities.
Yeah, I'm glad I missed that discussion because I've had it too many times. During my era, which was super competitive, you know, Reagan, greed is good era, the people who really used Spirit of the Game to their advantage were the hyper-competitive teams, and this was making your own calls. And as I say in the book, I played enough pickup basketball to know what happens when you make your own calls. It devolves quickly into an argument. So this kind of this kind of perfectionist notion led to its opposite during my era. I think it's gotten better currently, in part because of the use of smartphones and filming things. You're less likely to be a jerk if you're on film. So, but in our era, people would really use it to win. Which was too bad.
I should point out that a longtime sports writer, Steve Rushen, who's also a longtime friend of this show, objects to Ultimate Frisbee. He thinks it should be called Penultimate Frisbee. Yes. And he also objects to just Ultimate. He says, if you just call it Ultimate, it places itself at the apex of all human endeavors, better than sex, art, or spaghetti bolognese. For a sport played without balls, Ultimate certainly has a pair, writes Steve. So, the other question that I have, and Danny, I'll start you out with this one. You know, when I am often walking through the park and I see some people casually playing Ultimate Frisbee. And I often note that it's co-ed. Although what I really mean by co-ed is that there's 13 dudes and one girl. Is this, I mean, I don't know, is there, since I just mentioned Steve Rushen, are there Rebecca Lobos of Ultimate Frisbee?
Yes, Suzanne Fields is the great...
Well, if there's only one, it doesn't count.
Well, no, she was one, and there are others. Okay. And Dave
and
can
there
talk,
are many now.
Dave can talk about it at greater length, but the answer is yes, there are. And the great, I mentioned one name who was a pioneer and a great, great player. At the highest level, Ultimate is played co-ed because the structure of the sport, almost unlike any other sport I can think of, is that you can have players of varying ability on the same field at the same time, as long as they're covering each other. So, for example, we had John Korber, who may be out there listening today. He's a great player in Connecticut and was the coach and captain of the Connecticut Constitution professional team, playing in our summer league with beginners. And, you know, somebody covered John Korber, who was a professional player. I didn't. And other people covered the people of their level. So that happens. And, yes, the women's game has been slower to develop, but at this point is growing faster, and has some great, great players.
Hey, Dan O'Connor, when Danny or David mentions professional, what do they mean? I mean, I assume we're not talking about, like, $7 million contracts and stuff like that, professional Ultimate.
It is not $7 million, I can assure you that, but it is, I believe it's a stipend, it's tournament fees, yeah. It's travel expenses.
Yeah.
And I think David Gessner back in the 80s would have clamored for that because the expenses and the carrying of a team or an individual, for all those years that David, myself, and Danny have been playing, we've been picking up the dime the whole way along that I'm aware of. I don't want to speak for everybody, but it was basically
No one's ever paid me to play, no.
Exactly. So with that said, I think the professionalism is really covering... Again, a stipend, there's tryouts, there's time commitments, there's travel time. So I believe that is covered and then some. Are they making a living? I believe it's let's call it a second job, second career, yeah. But a true passion.
Oh,
and that's
David,
what gets them
the,
out.
The highest paid player right now, last year, was Bo Kittredge, who made around $50,000. And that was an astounding amount for Ultimate. As I like to say during my book tour, I'm still the highest paid Ultimate player
based on
the book.
Advance, yeah.
Yeah, that's all. But he's an extraordinary athlete. I just did a piece on him for Outside Magazine. 6'4", runs a 47-second 400, a 4.440, has done the football combines and crushed them. But he's making a pittance compared to pro sports, obviously.
And, you know, I mean, somebody alluded to this. I think it might have been you, Dan O'Connor. But there's a way in which – in many of the sports that we've grown up loving as spectators do seem incredibly compromised now. I mean, the football season starts in 8 or 9 days. The NFL season starts, and I'm as happy about that and excited about the Green Bay Packers as I possibly could be. But I also – it's now tinctured with this sense that there's something very wrong with all this. And certainly just the infusion of money everywhere else and the way colleges make insane – amounts of money off their athletes and coaches, you know, do make like $7-8 million a year, and the athletes get nothing. There's all kinds of ways, and Danny, maybe I'll start this out with you as the business reporter here. There's ways in which our childhood games have been it's a commonplace to say this. They've been corrupted by money. I mean, maybe that's the argument for this oddly sort of misfit and fame resistant game.
I don't think there's any question about it. Money and structure. And what one of the effects of the money and structure, ironically, is that the personality of the players and the captains doesn't come through nearly as much as it does in Ultimate, where there are no adults in the room. It's just us. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, one of the characters, two of the characters in David's book, arguably other than himself, the lead characters, Steve Mooney of Boston and Kenny Dobbins of New York, two very, very different clashing personality types. Steve Mooney, I was actually his first captain, David, which you may not know. There was a period when Steve Mooney did not know how to throw a forehand, and I witnessed that. It didn't last long. He was able to exert the type of leadership that led him to be a great champion for 20 years, over the period of six different teams, because there was no superstructure in the sport. He was it. He was exerting great leadership. Same thing with Kenny Dobbins in New York, a different type of leadership, a much more aggressive, bulldog, angry style, but really coming through in their personalities. And that comes through in the book, and I think that comes through in part because there is no structure, money over the sport.
All right. You know what? First of all, I want to thank everybody who's participated in this fine conversation. I've got one last question I've got to ask Dan O'Connor. So where can we get Frisbee pies now? If we just want to eat the pies, we don't want to play the game. How does that work?
Well, Colin, thanks again.
I mean, you brought some pies here. That's where I'm going to get my pies.
I'm very fortunate.
The rest of these people.
I brought some along for the studio and some other Trotsky's. But with that said, what's great about it, as I build out the business, as I mentioned, 7, 8 months, 9 months into it, the product is currently available, that being the pies. They come in three flavors. We have apple, blueberry, and cherry. They're in 4-inch snack pies right now. Mm-hmm. I'm rolling out a line coming into the fall, which will be the 8-inch, which will be a more traditional Frisbee pie that we're used to and have seen throwing around. But with that said, Colin, these are available today at Stu Leonard's across right down the road in Newington, as well as across the others throughout Connecticut.
Yeah.
As well as Restaurant Depot, which is stocking them in the Orange location, and will be moving to the other stores shortly within the Connecticut area. And lastly, we have a distributor, which is Wade's Dairy, which is supplying a lot of the local delis, restaurants, and caterers. So it's Wade's Dairy for local delivery, and the other two, as I mentioned, for pickup and purchase.
You got to get them into Highland Park. They're made for Highland Park. It's a product. I used to, of course, my father and I founded Sarah Whitman Hooker Pies, and we certainly sold a lot of them there at Highland Park. All right, so this has been a great conversation, or not, or we could maybe have no listeners left. I don't care either way. I'm that committed. David Gessner is the author of Ultimate Glory, Frisbee Obsession, and My Wild Youth. Please take a look at this book. It really will help you understand one of your friends in your life, like if one of your friends is Danny Haar or Dave Morad or Tim Helmecki. Also, Danny Haar, columnist for the Hartford Courant, a regular on many of our shows here, and Dan O'Connor, the president and CEO of the recently mentioned Frisbee Pie Company in Bridgeport. We're going to take a break, and we're going to talk about Danny Haar's next sport, pickleball. Coming to Hartford, Pickleball Ragnarok, the big one. Let's do some sailing.
This is amazing timing, but breaking news in the sports world. One of the biggest stars in Major League Ultimate Frisbee was disqualified today after he did not test positive for pot. Today's show was produced by Jonathan McFrisbee and me, Kyone Wolf. The part of Bill Curry was played by Tim Helmecki. On tomorrow's show, The Nose talks about the press obsession with Whole Foods, goat yoga, Princess Diana, or maybe none of those things. We don't know. And now, back to Colin.
Danny Haar just did something funny. All right, so, well, you got to admit, it isn't fair if everybody else is high and somebody isn't. That gives them an unfair advantage at Ultimate Frisbee. But first of all, we're not going to talk about Ultimate Frisbee anymore. We're talking about a different sport. And Patrick Fisher, who we're about to talk to, Patrick, I have to tell you something. These guys who've been talking about Ultimate Frisbee for the last 38 minutes, as we went into break, they went, "What, you really going to talk about pickleball? What, pickleball? You're going to talk about pickleball? What is pickleball? Who even knows what that is?" I'm thinking, you just talked about Ultimate Frisbee for 38 minutes. All right. So pickleball is a sport that we've actually talked about 5 years ago on this show. And now the USAPA is going to have its regional pickleball tournament in Hartford, October 26th to October 29th. This is the big one, baby. This is the big pickleball tournament. And so, Patrick, maybe we should say that you're the executive director of Connecticut Sports Management Group. And maybe you can describe briefly for people what pickleball is.
Sure, absolutely. And I appreciate you guys having us on. Pickleball is the fastest growing sport in America, if you can believe it or not. It's a combination of tennis, badminton, and ping pong. It's played indoors or outdoors. Court size is kind of relative to a badminton court. The net's a little lower than a tennis net, and it's played with a paddle. And then a ball that's similar to a wiffle ball, but it's got circular holes all over it. It's fast paced. Baby boomers are the largest population right now that's actually playing. They actually represent about 65% of that population that plays pickleball. And USA Pickleball and their regional director were kind enough to ask us if we would consider running this event for them, which is in its third year. We're close to being sold out. So we're going to have probably in the range of 450 to 475 pickleball players from about 20 different states here for a three-day tournament. And we're really looking forward to bringing this event to Hartford.
When you say sold out, you mean in terms of pickleball players competing as opposed to fannies in the seats, correct?
Correct. You know, we do expect some spectators, families, and friends to attend, but we're very close to being sold out in regards to what we can accept for registrations of actual players.
We want to move our show. We'll probably do our Friday Cultural Nose Roundtable from the pickleball tournament if we're allowed to. We want to be live from courtside at the William O'Neill State Armory in Hartford, which is where that's going to be. And when you say baby boomers, well, I'm a baby boomer. I'm 62. My knees hurt. I mean, there's a little bit of a component to that, right? To pickleball, it's like maybe if there's certain sports that I've had to say goodbye to, but I could probably continue to play pickleball.
Absolutely. It is the sport of Florida. If you know anything about the villages, they don't have enough courts right now to accommodate the growth of this sport and the number of people that want to play. All the park and rec, organizations throughout the state of Connecticut are scrambling to create programs because there's been such a desire for people to be able to play and find an area or a court or indoors or outdoors to be able to provide for that need.
This sounds like a joke, but I'm told it's not. Apparently, this is a very popular sport at nudist resorts. I don't know if that's anything you're aware of.
If you actually Google pickleball and look in the image sections when you come up to Google, you'll see some interesting photos.
Yeah, I think I'm not going to do that then. this is kind of an exciting thing for Hartford. If you get that many people coming and playing this particular sport. So I assume tickets will go on sale for the non-players at some point, right?
Correct. I mean, you'll be able to. It's a modest entry fee to get in for spectators. It's a $3 or $5 pass, depending on child or senior or average adult, and that's a weekend pass for the 3 days.
Well, I want to be like Spike Lee. I want to be like right at courtside, where people can see me watching pickleball.
Well, that's one of the nice things about the O'Neill Center, and that's kind of why we chose that facility. We're going to be creating 22 courts, and all the vendors will be around the courts, and you'll be able to have access to view all the players playing and, be able to hit up all the pickleball retailers and vendors that are going to be on site as well.
Patrick, I think Danny Haar and Dan O'Connor are looking at one of those pictures that you so infelicitously guided people to right now. They're passing a phone back and forth. That's a bad sign. It's great to talk to you. We can't wait for October 26th to October 29th. That's the regional pickleball tournament. It looks like it encompasses pretty much the upper eastern seaboard, and we are excited about that. It's coming to Hartford, the USAPA. It's pickleball, baby. It's big, and it's coming to Hartford. All right. I have to thank everybody who helped out with today's show. We're all a little exhausted here because last night we taped a show for the future at the Copper Beach Institute with just incredible musicians, and it was really a lot of fun, but we're a little tired here today. But this has been a fun topic to talk about to our 11 or 12 remaining listeners anyway, and we will be back tomorrow with the news. Thanks to everybody, especially Jonathan McPickle and Kyone Wolf. Dream of the clouds overhead. Wave your arms around like a spastic. Oh no.
everybody run, everybody run, Ultimate Frisbee.
I'm filing a formal protest against your team.
About what?
One of your players is a dog.
He's not a dog. He looks like a dog, and he's very sensitive about it. Can you lower your voice?
Sure, I can talk softer.
No. Actually, lower your voice. He can hear high-pitched noises really well.
Case closed.